What are some of the basic rules that you follow while investing in a company, and how have they evolved over the course of your investment career?
They evolved a lot, you know, and I think that applies to almost every investor. When I started practicing value investing about 25 years ago, I was purely a Graham investor. So I was doing statistical bargains, I was doing risk arbitrage. And the key source of margin of safety for me was from a low price, you know, a low price in relation to perceived value. Could be a cash bargain, could be a high dividend paying stock, could be a stock selling well below its net current asset. You know, all the standard filters that Graham has spoken about in his books. So you're not paying a lot of attention to the quality of the business or the quality of the management, and you're very quant oriented. And of course, that kind of a strategy will work provided you have lots of bets. You can't have five names. You need to have 40 names or even more. But over time, I became much more aware of the qualitative factors, you know, management factors, softer factors, things that are hard to measure. And it's very difficult to put them in an Excel model, for example. But they are very, very important. Investing with the right kind of entrepreneur who has the right kind of skill set and the right kind of ethics, for example, can create enormously beneficial outcomes. So over a period of time, I ended up thinking about investing in three buckets. So there is a business bucket, there is a management bucket, and there is a valuation bucket. In a Graham framework, the valuation bucket is of extreme importance, in a sense that the management may be mediocre, the business may be very mediocre, but a low price could offset the disadvantages of having a mediocre business in your portfolio or a mediocre management in running those businesses. But the process that I follow now requires me to first love the business. If I don't love the business, then there's no point thinking about the management, and there's no point thinking about the valuation. If I don't like the people who run the business, then I'm not going to say, well, the low price can compensate for all that. So yeah, valuation is important and very critical, but it comes after you have found a business that you love, and after you have found people who run those businesses that you love.
So typically, how much time does it take for you to research a company?
It's a good question. You know, I spend 6 months in a stock and getting a lot of confidence and ending up with very bad outcomes. I have spent 5 minutes on a stock and with excellent outcomes. And when I say 5 minutes, it doesn't mean that I just found a name and I bought that stock on the spur of the moment. You know, knowledge is cumulative. Sometimes you know that there is a great business out there and you haven't bought it because it's too expensive, but you know that they're executing well and it's a great business. But for whatever reason, the stock price falls. It could be company specific, it could be macro, it could be political, it could be whatever reason the stock price falls. And it doesn't take a lot of time for you to come to the conclusion that this is a great opportunity to be in. So 5 minutes is all that it took in this one case. And in another one, you know, you spend 6 months and you do all the work and you collect all the data and you make a big investment memo. And you have all this confidence, but it kind of blows up in your face. So yeah, these things happen. So I don't want to say that there is a set time that one has to spend before determining. I do want to say one thing though, which is there is this concept which, you know, the younger generation is much more familiar with, and they call it FOMO, the fear of missing out. Now, when you're doing research, if you're doing investing in a business, then one of the risks or one of the tendencies that you have to guard yourself against is FOMO, which is that the stock will run away and you haven't done the work yet. You know, other people are buying it and the stock is going up. One thing which is, again, very hard to do, but it's worthy of learning to do, is to avoid FOMO. That do the work, focus on the process. There is a process, there's a checklist for the business, there's a checklist for the management, there's a checklist for valuation. Finish the work. Before you finish the work, if it runs away, let it go. There will be other opportunities that will come. But rushing in without finishing the work because you gave into FOMO exactly during a bull market, for example, is likely to be very costly. I paid the price for that. And I'm not saying that I am, become completely irrational, but one of the things that I have working on very hard for myself is to get over this FOMO tendency.
Do you recall any instances where you spend just about 5 minutes on a stock and that gave you some really good returns?
Yeah. I mean, there's a company called P&G Hygiene and Health, and you know, we know that they own the Whisper, you know, sanitary napkin franchise, and it's very easy to see how, that it's a great business. Okay, now we're talking about a stock. I want to mention that I'm not recommending this stock. I mean, using this just as an example, and I don't own it now. So I just want to make the disclosure before we go further. So here was a case when they had a couple of bad quarters and the stock fell like 40%, and the business was excellent. It was then excellent, it's still excellent. And it was a very simple decision that, you know, the stock, you know, in a sense, it's like, you know, there is a famous song by Richard Marx, which goes along the following lines, that I'll be right here waiting for you.
Yeah.
So, you know, you've done the work. You already know that this is a business and you like what they do and how they're executing. It's just what you don't like is evaluation. And then it comes. It's come not because there's been an impairment. It's come because there's an overreaction to something that is not very important. A couple of bad quarters doesn't change the value at all, in my view, in the long run. India is a country where you have, you know, 1.3 billion people. Half of them are females and most of them don't use sanitary pads. So there is a large market out there. This company in the branded space has more than 50% of the market share. So it's a very long runway kind of a business. They also own Bull Spice, and they own one more brand. So it's a three brand company, and the stock fell a few years ago at a price which made me comfortable to own it. It was a 5 minute thing. There have been other situations where you spend a whole lot of time to gain conviction and then you give up because you just don't understand it.
Among other things, we've also spoken about moats, wherein a company has a definite advantage over its rivals and is able to protect market share. Now, how relevant are moats in today's world? You have a lot of this disruption happening because of technology, because of policy changes. So what are your thoughts on that?
Firstly, I mean, the fact that I believe in the concept of moat doesn't mean that I don't believe in the other concepts of investing. You know, as a teacher, I teach different styles of value investing. I teach investing like Ben Graham, you know, investing in debt restructuring, for example. I don't do debt restructuring. I don't do bankruptcy workouts. I have done them in the past, but I don't do them anymore. But that doesn't mean that you can't make money there. I mean, it's a great place to make money. I don't do risk arbitrage anymore, but I teach it. But I largely agree with you that the nature of moats is changing. I mean, standard moat businesses come from either brands, they come from intellectual property, they come from network economics, and they come from the low cost advantage. And I feel that out of these four, there is only one which is unchanged and is unchangeable, which is the desire for customers to pay low prices. That means that if there is a business which can earn a reasonably good return on capital while having the lowest cost advantage, that's durable. If it can focus intensely on maintaining that advantage, which means not getting too greedy about gross margins, not getting too greedy about your margins, and you know, trying to cut prices to the point where you're deterring competition. I think that source of moat is going to stay around for a long time, because I don't think human nature is such that they would like to keep paying higher prices when the whole world starts laughing at them, which is what happened in many cases, that there are these companies which charge very high prices for their products because they can, and in the past they could. But today, consumers are far more conscious about the high prices they're paying compared to alternate products that come by at much cheaper prices, but similar value propositions. One example that is often used in this context is that of Dollar Shave Club. And again, it's a good example to use because, you know, Gillette was spending enormous amounts of money in R&D and they have this extraordinary gross margins. And you would expect that this will last forever. But today, I think 13 or 14% of the market share has been taken away by this company. They don't spend a lot of money on advertising. They don't spend a lot of money on R&D. They give you a blade which is as good as any other blade. And they have turned it into a subscription model, which is very interesting because the subscription model is just an illustration of a point that it's not just about technology innovation or about the other point that you made, regulatory changes that can cause moats to get eroded. It's also business model innovation. So you have to worry about all of those things.
Very often, stocks that look like good bargains after having fallen sharply from their peaks turn out to be value traps. Of course, the reason why they're also called value traps is because they're hard to spot. So how does an investor distinguish between what's a bargain and what's a value trap?
It's a good question, and I deal with this all the time in my classroom. Knowing something that is cheap is one thing. Knowing something that is cheap, but cheap for the wrong reasons, and those reasons that are not permanent, is another thing. So the way to understand this is there is value and there are value traps. A lot of things that are cheap for a reason, and usually a very good reason. In fact, Ben Graham writes about this in his book, and towards the end of his security analysis, there's a chapter in which he talks about certain classes of businesses that he doesn't use the word value trap, but basically he's implying that. He talks about holding companies, for example, and we've seen, you know, holding companies which own shares in other companies and have nothing else. There's no business, there's no operating business, but they just hold shares in other companies. They tend to sell at very steep discounts to the breakup values. I mean, those shares could be sold in the market sometimes 3 to 4 times the current market value of the whole company. And it's very easy for a student of value investing to say, my God, this is so cheap, and therefore I should buy it. Now, it's cheap, we know that, that's evident, but should you buy it? And that depends on the presence or absence of a catalyst. How likely is it that that cheapness will go away? For that to happen, they have to sell the shares and distribute the dividend, they have to do massive buybacks, or they have to liquidate the company. If none of those things are going to happen, then the probability of the value being realized is low. And that's the important point for students to understand, that it might be cheap, but if it is not going to be, the cheapness is not going to go away for specific reasons, could be governance, could be structural, then it's probably a value trap. Then there are other kinds of value traps. You know, I do a whole series of lectures on this and give examples over there. But one of the classic value traps is the PE multiple value trap. That, you know, in a cyclical business which is experiencing a lot of shortage and an enormous jump in the profitability of that industry, the price has gone up 5, 6, 10 times, and the earnings have gone up even faster. The stock looks cheap, because you're looking at a PE multiple based on the last 12 months or the forward 12 months or something like that. 4, 5, 6 multiples, they start looking cheap. And Graham warned about that also in his books. He has a chapter called Trends. I think one of the best chapters I read in a book that Graham wrote was a small little book called Interpretation of Financial Statement. In that, there's a small chapter, just 2 pages, called Trends. And in that, he talks about a company which is experiencing a positive trend line in earnings and it's cyclical. And then the question you have to ask is, how likely is it that this trend will last, and how much of a price you already paid into that likelihood? I think it's important to recognize that things that appear to be cheap are not always cheap. And the vice versa is also true, by the way.